can't hear you.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech language pathologist.
Hi, Laura. I'm Kate Hensler, developmental interventionist with the First Steps program in Louisville, Kentucky. How are you tonight?
I'm really good. I've almost recovered from the holiday hoopla. How about you?
I've recovered. I'm going to have trouble getting back to the real world because I've been a napping fool. It's been awesome.
That is great. I'm so glad. I thought about you when I saw on the news the for your Thanksgiving plans at Churchill Downs. I saw the weather wasn't so great that day.
It wasn't, but we were inside. It was fun. Good tradition.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Well, today is Sunday, November 28th, and if you're listening right exactly at this moment at 6:01 Eastern Time, you're listening live, and we would absolutely love to hear from you if you're a parent or a professional with questions about late-talking toddlers. And our call-in number is 1-718-766-4332. And again, we would absolutely love a caller, but we do have some things planned just in case we don't have callers tonight. We have a couple of really quick questions that we're going to do. And then we have a study that we had talked about for the last couple of weeks discussing about autistic children don't seem to yawn contagiously. And this is posted on TeachMeToTalk.com's Facebook page if you want to take a look at that. So we're going to talk about that for sure. And then we have another couple of interesting questions. Should we have time to get to those? And I believe that we will because we're going to try our best to keep plowing ahead tonight. Sometimes we get a little talkative and stay on one question a long, long time, but I think these are really short and sweet and to the point, so I don't think that'll be the case tonight. Oh, before we get started, though, I do want to remind our listeners that this week I will be doing my Louisiana dates on Thursday. Is that the 2nd, maybe? Thursday, December 2nd, I'm going to be in New Orleans at the DoubleTree Hotel, which is in Kenner, and then on Friday, December 3rd, in Baton Rouge at the Hilton Garden Inn Airport. And there are a few more spots left for both of those conferences, but I know we're going to have a great time. But if you want to sign up, again, I think if you'll sign up tonight or tomorrow, we can get you in there, and I would just absolutely love to get to meet you and have you there at the conferences. All right, Kate, are you there while I blah-blahed on for like 3 minutes straight without breathing?
No, go ahead. Keep talking.
Okay. Okay, let's get started with this first question, and this is from a mom, and I do not have her name. I don't know what happened with that. But anyway, she says, "Hi, Laura. The information on your site is great. I have a 24-month-old little girl who is just now starting to put together two words. Her two-word combinations are along the lines of it empty, it hot, he mix, and other two to three other combinations. And in the past few weeks, she's picked up new words at a remarkable rate. I couldn't even begin to count them, and yet the ability to string the words together has not really presented itself. Would you consider this unusual or something to be concerned about? I've also noticed an increase in her speaking what sounds like a foreign language. Perhaps this is jargoning. If so, is this something to be concerned about?" And then she says, "Many thanks." And my take on this is no, that she is doing her little language explosion right now, and so she's learning new words at an incredible rate, and she's starting to do some of those combinations, which is what happens when children have their language explosions. And I would think that jargon is exactly what's happening. She's just wanting to talk in sentences but can't quite get the word, or phrases, and can't quite get the words in the right places. And so it does sound like it's a foreign language a lot of times when parents haven't really heard that before. But she sounds like she is doing great to me, and it's all within the realm of normal, and I just wouldn't worry about her one bit. Do you have something else to add to that, Kate?
No, it sounds like I agree with the jargon, and I have lots of parents who call it foreign language, and a lot of parents, or it's not uncommon for parents to think that it really is speech, and it's really not, and it's kind of like you described, like the child knows mom talks in sentences, so I'm going to do that, and she's just kind of
right.
Jibber-jabbering, making some effort at language, but, you know, the fact that she's adding those words so rapidly is a great sign. It sounds like she's, if not where she's supposed to be, she's very, very, very close, and give her
right.
a little time and she'll be right with her peers. So she's doing great.
That's what I think, too. And what I would do is take those new words that she's using or even those really familiar words and model lots of two-word phrases for her and see if you can get her to imitate those so that when if she's looking at you doing her little version of German or Japanese or French or whatever her jargon sounds like, sometimes kids do sound like it's a particular language. Haven't you had kids like that, Kate, that you think, oh, that sounds like German or, oh, that sounds like whatever.
Yeah, I most my families usually say Chinese, and I don't know why that is because it's a lot of times kind of short and choppy, and I think to it, somebody who doesn't speak Chinese, that's maybe how it
right.
sounds. They'll say, I think it's Chinese.
I've had a lot of little bossy. I've had kids that are bossy, like, dah, 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 you know, that's why I think parents think it sounds more like German. But it, you know, and it's not. And, you know, of course, we're making a joke about it, but we're not taking, please don't take any of this seriously that we think those children are speaking those foreign languages. They're not. But anyway, what I was going to say is model those more traditional little phrases, more please. If she's doing her jargon and, you know, and you can tell that she's asking for more juice, model, oh, you want more juice? Tell mommy, more juice. And really model those sequences there. It is really common for children to kind of have a core word and try to add other words to it to make a phrase, and it sounds like this little girl's core word might be it, and that's pretty smart to kind of pick, you know, a pronoun that means lots of different things, you know, it empty, it hot. So, again, that sounds like a pretty typical pattern to me. That's not something we would really teach in therapy. And again, maybe the moms read on the website about more traditional patterns that children might say, bye-bye, dada, or bye-bye, mama, or more plus something. But every kid kind of, you know, there's a variability there, and some kids kind of pick one little word as their core or their anchor word, and it sounds like, you know, she might have picked it. So I wouldn't worry too much about her at all. Just model those phrases and again, keep pumping those new words in to build her expressive vocabulary, and she'll be using phrases you can understand in no time. She might already be. I think this question's several weeks old. So my guess would be that every day and every week, her mom will hear more and more combinations that sound clearer and that make more sense. And so she should just keep pumping those words in there. She sounds like she's doing great.
I've had a number of kids pick up that it where parents frequently ask them, what is it? What is it?
Yeah.
Kids start saying it because they've heard, what is it? So many
That's
times.
A great point. Yeah.
I've had
That's
a
lot
great
of those
point. That I usually say, why don't you just say it's a dog? It's a, you know, so that they're not, because they, and they even, you. Some I've had some kids who do it, and they seem to kind of know, like, I'm just going
right.
to go with it because.
Yeah.
Mom
says it all the time.
That's
yeah.
what I hear all the time, so it seems to work for them. Yeah, but
it is funny when a parent has a word like that, or they don't even really know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Several years, or they don't realize they're doing it. Several years ago, I had a mom, and I've worked with her again since then. I've seen her. I saw her oldest child, and I skipped her middle child. Her middle child did great, and then I saw her youngest child, and she's a psychologist. And with her oldest child, who now is probably 7 or 8, he would say, before everything. And so, like a ball, a cup, a truck, a car, everything started with And so the mom, you know, being a psychologist, got concerned and thought he had all this atypical phonological development. But when you listen to that mom model, she would say, it's a car, it's a truck, it's a cookie. And so, but it's hard to recognize that in yourself unless mm-hmm. you have somebody come in and listen to you, and somebody who are, you know, picky like we are with listening for every little thing. And that's what he was doing. But, it, you know, to him, mom thought, okay, he's picked up some kind of Italian intonation here with adding, kind of before and after words. But really, I think he just did it because that's what mom did. And, again, you pointed that out. Maybe that's what this mom does with this little girl with it. So,
well, and she
who knows?
mom who's really involved in, because she's concerned about this little girl and probably really doesn't have any need to be concerned, and that's okay.
Right.
But since she's very in tune with her child's language, I'm guessing she is spending a lot of time saying, "What is it? What is it?" You know,
yeah.
And so the child says, "It." But she can quit worrying about this one. I think she's doing really well, and she's going to,
yeah.
If she's not already caught up, it'll be there, just like her language explosion took place with single words. She's going to be building two-word phrases very rapidly. So she's doing well.
She's doing great. All right, let's move on. This next question is from a mom named Kathy, and this is another quick question, I think. It says, "Hi, Laura. I read your site all the time. Great information. I have a 23-month-old son. He has a large expressive vocabulary, over 200 to 300 words. And again, I want to point out to moms that are listening, that's really a pretty typical vocabulary for a child who's turning two. That's what the research tells us, is that children whose language is moving along and who would be considered to have typical development would have 200 to 300 words at 24 months. She says, and he makes 2 to 3 word sentences. However, I've made myself sick with worry over one particular thing he does. She says, for some words, and she has that in quotes, and then in parentheses, she says, about 10, give or take, he deletes the initial consonant if he doesn't yet have it in his inventory. For example, she says, shoe becomes oo because he doesn't have the SH. Light becomes it. Frog becomes og. Toe becomes o. I read that initial consonant deletion isn't normal. He's quite intelligible for his age, with the exception of the few words where he leaves off the initial consonant. I'm just wondering if this is normal or it's a problem. Thanks." I do not think it's a problem if he has 200 to 300 words and only 10 or so of those have, he's leaving off that first sound. And I think this is the case. This is exactly what you just described, Kate, with that mom before. She's a mom who's really obviously in tune with her little boy, and she's almost overanalyzed his speech. He's not quite two yet, but he is leaving off those sounds, and just looking at the list, with the exception of toe for an initial T, the other words that she's listed, shoe with an SH, light with an L, and frog with an FR, those are all later developing consonant sounds. You know, SH usually comes in sometimes not until about 4, same thing with an L. Blends, many children cannot do consonant blends or use two consonants together until they're closer to 5. So he is trying to use the word, but because he doesn't have that sound, he's just leaving it off. And that is a very a typical response with, again, a kid who's not even 2, and he sounds great to me with having such a huge number of words in his expressive vocabulary, and he's doing phrases, and again, this sounds like a don't worry issue. If it's just an isolated few words, and if she said overall he's quite intelligible, and we know that just from research, parents should only understand kind of to be considered normal at least 50% of what he says. According to this, she understands him most of the time. So this is another one of those, I wish I could see Kathy in person and give her a hug and pat her on the back and say, "You're doing a good job. Don't worry. Move on. Pick a new issue," because this is not one to even spend 5 minutes talking about.
As we like parents who worry about children's speech and language development, this would be one. He is doing great. And I'm so excited, Laura, that you pointed out that toe thing, because that was the only one, as I read this, getting prepared, I thought, well, that's the only one that kind of surprises me, because those other ones are late sounds, so that's
right.
Just an answer to, I can't really say that, so I'm just going to drop it. So that makes me feel good that I did that.
I'm glad you caught that too. And probably my guess would be with toe is that that was a really early word for him, because that is a pretty common word that kids say, and that he probably said that so early and just kind of, it's over-rehearsed, and he just hasn't fixed it yet. He's just still leaving off that sound before he maybe, you know,
he might be able to say two, or he might be able to say...
Right.
Other
words that start with T. Yes.
Right. And I do see that with kids. Sometimes when it's one of their early words, they'll move way past it and get words that are really harder and more complex than in theory they shouldn't get. But they hang on to that early pattern that they learn, you know, one of their first, for whatever reason, he may have learned toe early on, and that's just how he says it.
Yeah, and he probably, if Mom pointed out to him, oh, my goodness, is that an O or is that a toe? And that's called using kind of a minimal pairs contrast. You might look at his little face and see the light bulb turn on and him say, toe. You know, so that maybe that's what I would do with him if I had him in therapy, is contrast it that way. If he's talking about his O's, I would say, is that an O or is that a toe? And see if he could imitate it correctly. Some kids might still think they're saying it correctly, and he might say, no, Mama, oh, and still in his little brain be saying it the same way that Mom is. And again, that's not that big of a deal at a kid who's just about to turn two, so I wouldn't worry about it at all. If she had said that, you know, out of his 200 words, that if it were reversed, that 190 of those words he left off the initial sound and he only had 10 words with initial consonants, then we would be worried. But, you know, just 10 or so out of that, you know, that she could kind of come up with concrete examples out of that big vocabulary list, I would not give it a second thought and just do some modeling, and chances are maturation is going to fix all of that. And if it doesn't, she can, and he's, you know, 4 or 5 and still leaving off initial sounds, or even at 3, you might have him looked at, but just based on what she said right now, I don't think it's a big deal at all, and I would not worry. And, again, pat yourself on the back. He's doing great with language.
Nor would I worry. I suspect that, you know, these are going to correct themselves pretty quickly, and language-wise, he's doing great. 200 to 300 words, 200 to 300 word phrases, not 24 months old. Woohoo! That's great.
Perfect. Yeah.
Yep.
That is perfect. Yeah, so those were quick and easy questions. Unless you have anything else to say to Kathy, we are going to move on even from there. I think this is record time for us. We're not even, we're a little past 15 minutes into the show, and we've done 2 questions already. That has to be a record.
Well, those were both, don't worry about it. They're doing great.
I know. Usually the opposite of what we get. Yeah.
Which is nice. Yeah,
but I do love moms.
On occasion.
I know, and I do love moms that are so concerned about their children, and even though in this both of these cases it would be unnecessary worry. So it is nice to hear from moms, though, where we say, nope, not that big of a deal. That's probably not going to be the case, though, with the questions that we take later in the show. But before we do that, let's talk about the study that we have mentioned for the last 2 weeks, and I talk about it in my conferences. But I did want to mention it, and again, it's on Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you can go to the teachmetotalk.com page and become a fan. You can get to that from my website as well. If you go to my website at teachmetotalk.com, you look in the right-hand corner about halfway down the page, and the whole there's a section on become a fan on Facebook, and I think it even has the first 2 or 3 little posts on the Facebook page, and you can click on that and go all the way back to the end of September is where I've listed this study. But this is interesting to me. The study says the results were that autistic children don't seem to yawn contagiously. And this is from let's see, what journal did this? Well, the link is from Health Day News, but I think it's from a more, I don't want to say reputable, from a journal. Let me just kind of read through it here. Oh, okay, it was published in the September-October issue of the journal Child Development. And the results were that children with autism spectrum disorder tend not to yawn contagiously. That is, yawn in response to seeing others yawn, a new study suggests. Yawning is a type of emotional contagion. It means that it's an unconscious response that reflects a recognition of how others are feeling. And haven't you ever been in a room, Kate, where somebody starts to yawn and then it just catches on like wildfire? Everybody
Absolutely.
In the room is yawning.
You're making me tired. Quit yawning.
Yeah. Even talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so funny. Every time that I talk about this in the conferences, I mean, within, I would say, 5 seconds of even saying the word yawn, at least a couple of people in the audience out of 30, 40, 50 women, a couple of people are yawning just from the mere hint of that. And what they did with this study is that they took children They had 28 children ages 6 to 15 with autism spectrum disorder, so children who had already been diagnosed, and 63 children without autism, and they matched them for age and mental development. And they had them listen to a story, and the storyteller purposefully yawned 4 times in the story. And so children that were, let's see, with 120 typically developing children ages 1 to 6 were there, and they listened to this 12-minute story, and the storyteller yawned 4 times, and children began contagious yawning, or again, just kind of reflexively or without, you know, without even being able to help it, they yawned within 90 seconds of seeing the storyteller yawn at about age 4. Now, I think it happens, I have it happen even with sometimes with our delayed kids in therapy, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
That 1 o'clock appointment, 2:30 appointment, where you've had lunch and you start to get a little sleepy sitting there on the floor, especially in those houses that keep that heat turned way, way up, and you get pretty warm and full and start to yawn. I've even had children in my, you know, just my personal experience start to do that. But with the typically developing children, 35% of 4-year-olds, 40% of 5- and 6-year-olds started yawning within 90 seconds of seeing the storyteller. In the second experiment, they took the children with autism, and only about 11% of those children yawned. So quite a difference between the 35 and 40% and the 11%. And my guess would be is if we took adults, don't you think it would be closer to like 80 or 90% of adults who might yawn after a storyteller started doing that? I have to kind of suppress it when somebody does that. Don't you fight that?
Right.
Where you try to kind of keep yourself from doing it. Why am I talking about this, and why is this significant? The reason that this is important is that in autistic children, they are so disconnected emotionally or from what other people are feeling or from what they recognize about others' faces or the cues that they get in conversation that they don't have that, again, that reflexive or uncontrolled response to something as natural or normally occurring as yawning when someone else yawns. So what it means for us clinically is that we have to really work on imitation and work on helping those children pick up on those social cues and recognize another person's affect. It's a really high percentage as to what amount of communicative information we get from the nonverbal cues in a conversation, and our little friends who are on the spectrum really, really struggle with that. And so this study really highlighted that even something as basic and reflexive as yawning that children with autism don't copy, even when they're, again, when it's uncontrolled on their behalf. And so for us, again, as clinicians, it just highlights the fact that we really have to teach those teach social awareness and teach imitation, and sometimes in a really, really direct way, because children with autism don't naturally pick that up on their own. Did you want to talk about this at all, Kate?
Oh, I just wondered, and I'm embarrassed to say I haven't read the study. I guess I'll have to do that, but I just wondered if the underlying cause is a lack of focus on the face. I mean, that certainly is kind of a defining characteristic of autism, is they don't tend to engage in much eye contact and don't. And I do remember from years ago there was a study about babies and autism, and I don't really remember the details of it, but typically developing babies were very focused on the eyes, and even autistic kids, I don't remember what they focused on. It wasn't the eyes. And I don't know if it was even part of the face, but
right now there's a researcher named Sally Rogers with the Mind Institute in California, and she's doing lots of research with children, with siblings of children who were really still infants, like in that 6 to 9 month range. Siblings of children who've already been diagnosed with autism, and she's looking at them, and she says that many, 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 a high percentage of those 6-month-olds pay more attention to a cause-and-effect toy you know, a really cool toy than they would their caregiver's response to that, and typically developing children, and again, I think this study is on my Facebook page too, typically developing children pay the same amounts of attention or their, you know, that joint attention piece, their attention was split between the caregiver's response to the toy, looking at their mom or dad to see what, you know, they thought about the cool peekaboo toy or the jack-in-the-box or whatever toy they used. But the children who were more at risk for autism were hyper-focused on the object, and really their parent had no response to their parents, you know, didn't look at their parents, didn't alert to their parents' words or their parents' nonverbal responses or anything. So, again, that goes back to your point with them not being aware of faces, and you know, that's just not what they're interested in. They're usually more interested in objects than people.
Right, and so often working with this population, I spend lots of my time with my face and theirs, getting their attention, basically forcing them. And it is something that you see them improve on, generally. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it gets a lot better, but it's not that instinctive part is really not there. It's something they have to be taught to do.
Right.
And you see, even once it's better, a lot of times kind of kids come and go on it, or if there was somebody they're not entirely comfortable with, it shuts down. You know, it's
right.
I don't know if it ever becomes as strong as it is in a typically developing child, but it's certainly something that can improve quite dramatically. But I know you do as well, Laura, spend lots of time. I mean, that's kind of that social reciprocity piece that if it's not there,
right.
You don't really have much to build on. So this study doesn't surprise me all that much, I guess.
Mm-mm. Me either, but I just thought it was interesting that they took something, again, as reflexive as yawning, and they didn't have, like, a really obvious imitation task, because we know that children on the spectrum that we work with, when we see them as, you know, late one-year-olds and, you know, from the time that they're 2 to 3, since we work in a birth to three program, excuse me, that, you know, we would think about that those children have a really hard time imitating actions, imitating sounds, imitating words, but to make it kind of a more basic response than even that with a yawn, and again with something that, you know, as we grow older, we don't even mean to yawn. We just do it, you know, we can't even control it when we see someone else yawn. It's something, again, that I've been using the word reflexive, but that's not really in this review of this study, so I don't know if I just kind of added that word on my own. But again, I think about yawns as being something that you don't really make yourself purposefully do that. It just kind of happens. It's just an automatic response. And so that's what was so interesting to me, is that they didn't have it with something as that we would normally see, like on a behavioral observation. You know, with looking at an imitative task, we would have looked at whether a kid could imitate something we did with a toy, or imitate a word, or imitate even something like a gesture, like clapping or waving, and not something as naturally occurring as a yawn. So that's why I thought it was so interesting to look at it from that perspective. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay, so much for that. There we go. So if you want to take a look at that, that was from the September-October issue of Child Development, and the link to that is on teachmetotalk.com's Facebook page, and you can get there if you're not very Facebook savvy by just going to my website and clicking on it directly from the website. All right, those are the three things that we have been meaning to talk about for 2 or 3 weeks now, and now I feel better since we've gotten those covered. Okay. Let's do one more interesting question that I had, and this is from a dad. I would think it's a dad named Dickie, and he says, "Hi, I'm interested to know how is the ESDM cited in the CNN article compared with what you teach in your DVD?" And I think that this dad is probably referencing my first DVD, Teach Me to Talk, that is available from the website. And in that DVD is just a really basic presentation of how we target expressive language or work on that early talking with children who have some delays in that area. And so on the website, I linked an article that was from, it was on CNN's website from November 30th, 2009, so this is a little old now. But the original CNN article said that a study, it was reviewing a study that said that early autism intervention in toddlers is effective. And so the dad wanted to know how this study and the study that they said with the approach that's more effective relates to the same stuff that I'm using in the DVD. And I would say that the approaches are really, really similar, because in the article that CNN listed, it compared traditional therapy that lots of research supports is applied behavioral analysis, or ABA, and it compared that therapy approach, which usually means that there's an instructor who sits at a table with the child, and the instructor totally leads the activity, and the child, it's very structured, and it's very dependent on the child giving the correct answer and being tangibly reinforced with either a sticker, or maybe it's even an activity that the kid likes. A lot of them will use, maybe a blower or something, you know, give a kid an opportunity to do something they want to do, and then they're right back to that structured approach. Whereas the kind of therapy that we do and that we talk about on the show is more child-directed, meaning that it's on the floor. You're giving a kid a choice maybe between several developmentally appropriate activities. There's lots of nice give and take. Again, it's not as structured, meaning that if the kid's sick of the first activity that you pick, you move on. You, obviously don't want to do it anymore, again, you would follow their lead in wanting to pursue what would be their natural interest there rather than following a structured lesson plan. I certainly know with children, sometimes I'll go in with 10 toys, and we may end up playing with what they have right beside them if they're more interested in that day. So, again, it's a more child-driven approach versus structure that the adult sets up. So, they were using, let's see, the EDSM is called the Early Start Denver Model. And, again, this is by that same person that I just mentioned, Sally Rogers from the Mind Institute from California. That's interesting that it's the same researcher, and I didn't realize that until I just looked at it here. But if anybody wants to take a look at that article, that's on my website at teachmetotalk.com from... Oh, shoot, I can't get back to the site, but you could take a look at that. Here it is. It was from December 7th, 2009, so about a year ago. And the name of the article that I wrote is Good News from Research That Supports Early Intervention at Home for Young Children with Autism. And basically what Dr. Rogers is doing is just training parents, Kate, with the same approaches that we talk about all the time, with being playful and being fun and really responding to a child's interactions and letting it be more back and forth, real life, fun, interaction versus, again, really structured and not very much fun. So kind of comparing more of a floor time approach to ABA. And so, yes, the DVD would support the kind of therapy that the study supported as well.
Well, because...
And with that,
well, I was just going to say, Laura, about your Teach Me to Talk, you talked about working on expressive language, but I'd say that selling a little short, frankly, there's a lot about how to engage kids in play and how to do that effectively,
right.
How to keep them with you, how to get their attention and hold their attention, all those things that with typically developing kids is easy, and with language-related kids, it's not so easy always. So all those things would certainly play into this model where it is on the floor and it's, maybe a give and take between child-directed and adult-directed, but it's about play and it's about a social connection.
Right.
And it's about a relationship between the therapist, whether that therapist be the mommy or a trained therapist or whomever is engaging the child. But it doesn't surprise me. There has been a real lack of solid research And I think I've always said, you know, in this part, of the, we go to this subject on a fairly regular basis, but we don't really hear that much about ABA for very young children here in Louisville,
right.
Kentucky. But, you know, if we found ourselves in California doing this job, we would hear a lot about ABA. And I just think, and this is just, you know, me talking, not no big expert here, but just like my normal response would be, ABA with a one-and-a-half-year-old? ABA with a one-and-a-half-year-old? I mean, you know, take a typically developing child, just the most normal, average, typical two-year-old, and sit him at a table and try and get him to do something for an hour and insist that they do what you want them to do and just let me know how that goes. You know, I mean, I think, come on, got to be kidding. And so to take a child who isn't typically developing and doesn't engage easily and doesn't really necessarily appreciate the task at hand, I just can't imagine even trying to do it. And I always, you know, preface or follow that with, I do understand that ABA can be very effective. I just don't see it as appropriate for very young children. You know, there may come a time when that same kid's going to be great with ABA. But, you know, under three, I mean, those are very young children. So
they're babies.
Yeah.
And the study that's this in the CNN article, the children in the trial were between 1.5 and 2.5 at the beginning of the study. Half of the children were given the community-based interventions or therapy, meaning the ABA model, and the other half were doing this Early Start Denver model that Dr. Rogers does. I think it's Dr., I'm pretty sure. But again, she's at the University of California, Davis, the MIND Institute, and her program consists of lots of parent training and lots of play-based activities. She says, and when she's talking about this is a quote, talking about how she describes the program, she says, it's a very pleasing kind of therapy. The kids are happy. The parents are happy. It's play, and it can happen everywhere. And so the results of the study were that the children who were in the play-based approach had IQ scores that were about 10 points higher at the end of the trial than the other children who just had the ABA therapy. And that the other factors that they measured, which were more subjective, like eye contact and those things, were improved as well.
The scores were understanding, as well as motor skills and self-care skills were all higher in the the Denver model. And I totally believe that. I would guess there are some things that are even not measured, that because I think the fact that they're building on that relationship and it is a very social encounter, you know, I can't imagine that there aren't some things that they don't test or don't measure that look better as well.
Exactly. And, you know, we all have kids as therapists who've worked for a while who test better than they really look. You know, they might be giving the right responses as far as, you know, pointing to the right picture or saying the right kind of rote response, but not be getting the social parameters that we all use, eye contact, the joint attention, the laughing and the playing, and just looking like they're engaged and enjoying an activity and their play being really purposeful versus kind of random. And again, versus, you know, a child who might not be saying any words, but yet they're still right there with you. They're laughing and looking at you again and doing all those nice social things that, again, may not be as easy to measure on a test. So I would take a kid like that and think prognostically he's going to do a lot better in that kind of real-life situation further down the road once you pump those words in and get that language going versus the kid who might just be responding rotely or echolalic and lack that social connected piece. So I'm kind of off on a little tangent there, but the social aspect is crucial. And anytime we can kind of build that in our approach from the beginnings with children, like when all play-based approaches do or floor time approaches do versus, you know, the ABA sit at the table and do it or else kind of approach. So, and again, I'm sure if anybody's listening and they're an ABA person, they are many different ways that you could implement that more structured approach. I'm sure there are some ABA people who work with toddlers that aren't at the table with you know, the two toys, and this is our choice for the day, and, you know, like it or else. I'm sure there are some ways that you could be a little bit more flexible about that. But from our perspective, the more natural play-based approach is certainly the way to go with children who are that young. And we know that it works because that's what we do every day. That's what we see every day. So naturally, that's what we're going to be a little more inclined to support, regardless of what the study says. But I'm glad that the study backs up what we do. So that's on the
website.
It is true.
There has been kind of a lack of definitive study that supports. And the more, kind of well-read, educated parents sometimes do read about ABA and think that might be their solution, even with very young kids. And it can be kind of, you know, a little uncomfortable or difficult sometimes to say, well, this works. We just don't necessarily have the research to support it the way ABA does.
Yeah, because
ABA is
all
so...
it's easier to measure than
mm-hmm.
what we do, and it's almost easier to administer than what we do, because it's, again, really black and white. And so much of the play-based approach is it's hard to measure that. It's hard to design a study where, you know, there are not all these different factors coming in. So I'm glad that Sally Rogers at the Mind Institute is doing that so that we do have some scientific data to support a more play-based, relationship-based approach versus the super scientific, super structured.
Well, and being in California, don't you know she hears about ABA, ABA, ABA all the time? I don't know much, but apparently there's a lot of funding available for kids on the spectrum and ABA therapy in California. So that's not the only approach there, but it is much more common and, you know, utilized in that part of the country and other parts, just really not here much. But I know she's happy to have some research that supports her approach, and we're glad that she's both a practitioner and a scientist, so she's doing the research. Keep doing it.
Keep doing it so we can all have some backup for what we're doing. Okay.
We know, like you said, I always say, Laura, I think that, you know, anybody doing studies on early intervention, there is no better case. Not one particular subgroup of delayed children, you know, that beats autism in the wow, this is so beneficial. I mean, we have all had on our caseload that we started at 18 months or 24 months, and they looked really delayed and really atypical. And by 3, we're thinking it's a miracle. Not that they're necessarily, quote-unquote, fixed, but they are entirely different children, you know.
Entirely different. And that's why, when, you know, you hear in stories and, you know, anecdotal things, or even about celebrities that write books about, you know, their children were saved from autism. And I just kind of shrug and think, gosh, I see that every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see kids that I feel like, in my opinion, were quote unquote saved from autism because we implemented the right strategies and the right approach and got mom and dad on board, and everybody's working on kind of the social piece, and everybody's working on receptive language, and everybody's working on that play-based approach to expressive language. So that, again, like you've said, they look totally different. And had you not done that, you know, who knows what would have happened. So I feel like that every day, you know, when I hear stories about that. And would that same child have gotten diagnosed with autism, you know, at a later date? We'll never know, thank God, because they're better. They're better. So that's, you know, all I care about.
And even sometimes if they do have a diagnosis and that, you know, that's never going to be, quote-unquote, cured, the long-term prognosis is so much more positive because of that early intervention. And it doesn't stop at 3. You know, it keeps going, and there's going to be other issues and other things to address. But still, you know, I hope there's not somebody out there thinking, they look different, what's wrong? Well, because these are kids who are not connected, not even to their parents, really, you know. And
kids
go from really very disconnected and very withdrawn to, my friend walked in and I'm excited and I'm smiling and I'm running over to play with her. Or my mommy, I love my mommy. Look at me twinkle as I look at my mommy. I mean, that's a huge, and I can't imagine there's not a parent who's dealing with a child on the spectrum who doesn't want that, you know. So I don't want to step on any toes with they look different.
Oh, no.
But,
right.
Know.
But we mean just there's, again, that social response is like night and day. Before they might have been really, really flat, really, really aloof, really, really distracted, bored, disinterested, doing their own thing versus smiling and playing and laughing and having a wonderful time doing something with someone else versus just kind of randomly doing their own thing. So that's what we mean by that. And again, you know, we don't mean that it's different in a really negative connotation, just kind of looking at it from a social perspective. Those kids do look so much better in that regard.
And having parents tell you specific things about, you know, sometimes it takes even months after we've been working with kids, but they begin to notice things themselves. They say things like, you know, it never really happened before, but now when he hears the garage door close, he knows Daddy's home, and he gets all excited, and he runs to see him. And, you know, that's
right.
Something that a very young child would typically do, and here's a kid who may be 2 or 30 months. And I think, yeah, because he gets it. You know, he now he's really excited Daddy's home, which is every parent wants that.
Exactly. Or you'll see a kid that mom says, gosh, for a long time, the only time I really saw him smile is when he just did X, Y, or Z. And now it's all day. He's happier. He's easier to live with. I can get his attention. He seems like he wants to be with us. And those are real life, everyday things that make a huge difference in even how parents feel about their own child. A lot of times moms and dads feel really guilty when their children aren't socially responsive, and they take all of that on themselves, and that this is something I did or something I didn't do. And so it does alleviate a lot of that when the mom thinks, oh my gosh, he's so with me now, he's so connected to me. And you know, so many times that's what we notice before we hear a lot of words or before we see a lot of objective progress on a test. And those are things, again, that you can't really measure when you're doing a study. But they're the things that make the most difference in everyday life and the most difference in how severe a kid looks. If you were just looking at, you know, children on the spectrum as a whole, whether they're mildly affected versus a child that we would say had a more severe presentation. So that's kind of the difference we would be looking at there, too. That's what we mean by that. All right, let's move on before we really get ourselves in trouble, okay?
Okay. Good idea.
All right. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about, let's see, which one should we do now? Let's do the one with a little boy. Okay, no, let's do the one from the other one because it was an earlier question. It's from someone named Erin on November 22nd, and again, this is on my website at teachmetotalk.com, and Erin says, I have a 22-year-old niece, and reading this, I really think she means month-old, don't you?
Yeah.
We just kind of type year-old out of habit, but let's go with the assumption that she's 22 months old, who I fear may have some issues. She was a late crawler and walker. She walked at 18 months and is not saying a word or communicating at all. She doesn't point, clap, wave, or any other form of communication. She responds to her name about 75% of the time and knows where Mommy, Daddy, Graham, and Aunt Erin are when asked. She doesn't play with her toys properly except for pushing buttons to get music, or lights to play. We thought her drooling was an issue of teething, but it appears that she has fairly low muscle tone in her mouth, jaw, and tongue. She's in speech therapy once a week, and she's being evaluated by our State Help Me Grow program. Do you know what state that is?
I don't really. It's a cute name, but I don't know it.
I've heard that before, but I don't remember. Johnny, that may have been somewhere we've been because that sounds really familiar. But anyway, she says, but the process has taken a long time to initiate and an even longer time to implement the next steps. And just for parents that are listening, early intervention programs are federally mandated to get services or, you know, get a child evaluated within 45 days. That's the federal law. But, boy, that seems like that month and a half goes so slowly for parents when they're really concerned about children. So, again, that's kind of our state has had a big push on getting all of those initial evaluations done and services started within that 45 days. And then you have 21 days after that 45 days to see a child for the first time for therapy. So that would end up, what, a little over 2 months.
Right.
And that can feel like an eternity to a family waiting on services. That's the frustration.
I think we all have the same laws, but I have heard of stories from people in other states where they might get that eval in 45 days, but they are not getting therapy 21 days after that, particularly
right.
speech, because that's the
right.
one that so many kids in early intervention get. But even other therapies, and I don't know how they get a lot around the federal regs, but they do. I don't know.
And probably the truth is that their state's probably in trouble about that. And I just feel so proud of Kentucky, you know, because you hear about our southern states sometimes having such a bad reputation as far as educational programs go, but we're pretty progressive in how we meet those federal guidelines and really do. Unless there's extenuating circumstances, our state does our program, or at least our district, does a pretty good job of getting services initiated.
I think even on the state level, we're good. I don't know why, but you're right.
No.
I think we should give ourselves a little round of applause in Kentucky, because we do get
Here
a lot
Kentucky,
of jokes
yeah.
about our. But our early intervention is good, and it compares
yeah.
favorably to a lot of other states. So, but I do know. So hopefully there, wherever Help Me Grow is not one of those states that's way behind on their timeline. So.
I know. So I hope that they're getting, and that was, let's see, the 18th. That was last week. So this letter's about a week old. And she says, what can we do, if anything, in the meantime? What kind of therapy should we push for once it gets to that? Physical therapy, occupational therapy, thanks for your feedback. Well, they are going to tell you what she's eligible for and what the initial evaluator recommends that she get. In our state, in Kentucky, we have the primary level evaluator model, meaning that one therapist comes and administers a standardized test that covers all developmental areas. So the one person, and usually it's the person is in the discipline that is your main concern. So for this little girl, I would assume that it's speech, since she's writing about it. And so the speech person would come, but they would also decide what other areas she met the criteria for. Usually it's 1.5 standard deviations below the mean, and that's fancy talk for a pretty big delay. In motor skills, you know, if it's gross motor, she would get a physical therapy assessment. If it's fine motor, she would get an occupational therapy assessment. If there were some sensory issues, or she also had some delays, say, in her self-help skills, she wasn't trying to dress or feed herself or do any of those little milestone things in that area, they would look at it as an OT as well. Some states still have the model where the speech person goes and looks at speech. The physical therapist goes and looks at her walking or her gross motor skills. So, and again, we're not sure what state this is and what your model would be, but they will tell you, based on her test scores, what services they recommend for her. So you don't really have to, quote unquote, push for what you want, because they will tell you what she qualified for. Now, that being said, if you're still concerned, say she's maybe unsteady since she's 22 months and she's a new walker still, if she doesn't technically qualify for PT, in some states you can say, I still want a physical therapist to look at her, I still would like for her to get some PT. In some states you can still do that, but in a lot of states, if she doesn't qualify based on how she scored on the test, she doesn't get that service. And if you wanted her to be evaluated for that, you would have to do what you've already done for speech for her, because it sounds like she's getting speech privately, that they've initiated that on their own before they initiated participation in their state program.
Laura, I looked up Help Me Grow. One of the states that calls it Help Me Grow anyway is Ohio, so that could be why it's familiar to you.
Well, I was just in Ohio in October, so I should have remembered that. Johnny, it was Ohio.
One of them. I don't know. So, you know, it's First Steps in Indiana and First Steps in Kentucky, so who knows? There may be another Help Me Grow state, but Ohio is one of them. So.
Yeah, but they will tell her, and in that state, I think in Ohio they have different, you know, she would qualify for if they felt like the physical therapist was necessary, they would have the physical therapist go look at her, because that Ohio is different in that lots of county or the counties kind of do their own thing within kind of the guidelines of their state program. And some states really have, like our state, is more controlled at the state level, and then we just kind of do what the state office, the central, you know, district or whatever, the state regulatory agency would tell you. But in Ohio, it's my understanding that every county kind of administers their program a little differently. So we're even more confused about what she might qualify for.
Which county they're in, which is,
yeah.
I think, one of the reasons Kentucky's program is very strong, and Indiana's the same way. It helps that to have that unity and to have a state approach, even though it's implemented
right.
on a county level or a group of counties.
District. Yeah.
Yeah, district then. But we'll hope for Erin that this little girl is in a county that's got it together and that they're going to get some good services there. We don't know. So.
Yeah, I met a great therapist in Ohio when I was in Columbus, and in Cincinnati both had super early interventionists who attended the conferences, and they were great. And so I hope that she's in a really progressive county and gets speech. I wonder if you're going to continue speech with her privately, excuse me, or just do the county program. But the question, what can we do, if anything, in the meantime? There's a ton of stuff you can do, and I've got the whole website devoted to that and a ton of DVDs about that. But for the most part, she said that she is understanding some really basic things like where's mommy, daddy, grandma, Aunt Erin. So you want to really be sure that you're targeting how she understands language and how she's learning to follow directions and link meanings of words with their objects and with those actions so that she can come to understand words and understand language, because children have to understand words before they even have a prayer of being able to talk. So receptive language is going to be, in my opinion, a huge focus for her. So that's certainly something that she should do. Since she has that low muscle tone, that's already been identified, and since she's a late crawler and walker, we know that those words are going to be later to come in too. But the important thing is that she would really evidence that she understands lots of those things. Now, Erin doesn't say anything about how socially connected she is. And I would pay a lot of attention to that, too, with how she participates in little games like patty cake and like peekaboo, and how she'll want to stay with you when you're singing with her and playing with her. And you do want to be sure that you're addressing that as well. But hopefully you can get some good ideas from taking a look at the website. And then Teach Me to Talk, the first DVD I did, will show you exactly how you should work with her and the kinds of activities that you could target. And then Teach Me to Listen and Obey 1 and 2 targets receptive language skills as well. So you might want to take a look at that as well. But the whole website, if you're just clicking through those articles in expressive language or receptive language, should give you some ideas of what you can do in the meantime while you're waiting on therapy to start. And certainly I would hope that you've learned some things already in the speech therapy that you've already done with her, but she didn't give us too much information about that, did she?
No. I'm guessing maybe. Well, this is the aunt. It sounds like the child responds to where's Erin. So this is a very hands-on involved aunt, because the child knows who she is. I'm guessing because she's doing private therapy, they're probably going to a clinic or something.
A clinic, yeah.
She may not know what's going on there because she hasn't been around to see it, which is one of the advantages of doing the early intervention route. It'll be in the child's home and
right.
to observe when it's in your living room. A lot of times in clinics, they take them back to a room and you bid them adieu and say hello when they come back, and you don't necessarily know what's going on.
And I just hate that for babies. I just hate that, because I really think having mom and, you know, Aunt Erin, who took the time to write us for the podcast, you know, she's obviously involved. And so a benefit to early intervention in a program being in your home is that they will come there, and that everybody can participate and everybody can learn the strategies that the therapist would feel would be most beneficial to help her first learn to understand words and then be able to use those words when she's ready. I hope that you're signing with her, Erin, if that's not something that they've started with her in therapy. That's certainly something that we would implement right away with her, and just really basic signs, you know, more, eat, if she, whatever her favorite little snack is, cookie or crackers, you know, you can certainly implement those early signs. Milk is one I, or drink, I almost always teach and eat in one of those first sessions. So there's some great information on the website about that as well. You can also take a look at the DVDs, and we have done lots of shows about using signs with children. And so flip through the podcast, the log of the previous shows, so that you can hear some ideas about how to implement signs with her as well, because that would be a strategy that I would start today if you haven't learned some of those basic signs.
And Laura, do you know, I want to say that years ago I went to a training in Ohio, and it seems to me they did have some sort, and I think maybe you and I spoke about this not too long ago, about there's kind of a, it's not called a developmental interventionist or developmental therapist, but they have kind of their answer to that maybe?
They do. It's special instructors. They
okay.
have early interventionists. You know what? Maybe special instructors in Missouri. I'm getting all the titles mixed up. But they do have people
have
that are
something.
Like you.
Right.
Yeah. That are through the Help Me Grow program that are specifically assigned. And it sounds like it, since she's globally delayed, she doesn't use any of those gestures. And certainly those are where we would start with therapy too, with helping her learn how to clap and wave and those following those really early kinds of commands. My guess is that she's going to qualify for specialist for speech, and then probably for OT or PT as well.
Right.
So I'm hoping they're going to get
and
lots
so
of services.
So, you know, I shouldn't hold you up as a sacrificial lamb on this, but do you know in Ohio if they get, you know, they get that specialist person, and then they also get discipline-specific therapists? Or,
yes,
and
they get both.
Do the specialist person more, or is it?
I believe it just kind of depends on the needs
on
the of the child, whether they determine what's, and I know that they, in Ohio, they were like we are in Kentucky, and like we certainly were when we worked in Indiana, the rural areas just have the early intervention specialists working on speech when they can't, you know, there's a shortage of speech therapists everywhere. And so I know that they spoke about that specifically, specifically at the conference in Columbus. There were several, specialists who were talking about that they were it in their rural county. So I hope that she gets lots of services, and more importantly, I hope that Mom and Dad and Grandma and Aunt Erin and everybody who loves this little girl can learn what to do to help her, because she sounds like she just has great support from that big family of people who love her. So hopefully we'll get a letter back from Aunt Erin in a couple of months and let us know how this little girl is progressing. But I'm so glad that they've gotten her in therapy, and she's not quite two, so it's the perfect time to start, and they certainly sound like a really loving, on-the-ball family that they're moving along with this, so that's great.
I guess the only other thing I would add to Erin is encourage your, I guess it's her, she's the aunt, so it's her sister's child, I guess, or I'm assuming that, you know, to be progressive about who they get if they have any friends or coworkers or acquaintances who have had children in the system, ask who they've had. Ask their pediatrician if she knows of any good therapists, because that's important too. And if they can get somebody good from the get-go, that's going to help the baby do better ultimately and help them get more comfortable more quickly with what they should be doing. And if they get somebody, if they are randomly assigned somebody, or they're not able to get names, or they get names and those people aren't available, you know, really pick the people's brains, give them opportunity to do their best work and to help you along. But if you feel like, you know, don't wait too terribly long to say, okay, maybe we need somebody else. So just You know, sounds like Erin's really on top of it. Probably her sister is too, but I do see cases sometimes where people keep therapists for months and months and months and even a year. And in their heart of hearts, they're thinking, I don't think this is really right. It doesn't really seem to be helping all that much. And I think,
right.
Oh, you shouldn't have waited. You should have moved on. Assuming they're in a place where there's some kind of option. Now, I don't mean to say that from the get-go, but best case scenario, they could get some names of people that have good reputations, are known to be very family-oriented and are going to work with them and help them, and they can just start off from the get-go with good folks. But if it doesn't pan out that way, give them a fair shot, talk to them, give them lots of opportunity to help you, and if it's not happening, then look around. There's probably somebody else who could do a better job.
Well, there you go. I just don't think I have anything to say about that. Just putting it out there, aren't you?
Let
no, it is good advice. If you don't,
well,
if you don't have a good,
you know,
a connection, yeah, you're wasting time.
It is. It's, you know, okay, now she's been in 8 months, and the family really wasn't instructed properly, and the therapist didn't really necessarily know what she was doing so well. And so a lot of time has gone by, and it makes me sad that somebody didn't say to them, and this is, you know, we don't know her, we don't know her therapist, this is just a general word
general.
Of advice.
Yeah.
If you don't feel like this person is helping the child, and even more importantly, helping the family to know what to do, because the greatest therapist in the world isn't going to see that child really enough to make a huge difference. The difference is going
right.
to come from what she helps the family know and change
right.
and implement. So, you know, if that isn't the case, then it is okay, you know, to look around and get the next person. So don't want to set a negative stage there, but just in case.
It's reality.
It is.
Yeah, and this isn't about anybody in particular, anybody specific. This is just an observation that you have had based on your personal experience and mine and just, you know, for doing this kind of job for a long, long time. And certainly the letters that we get and the callers we've gotten over the past couple of years on the podcast lead us to believe that that happens a lot with parents who still feel kind of lost with what they should be doing for their child. So if you don't have a good match and you don't feel like you have someone who's helping you along, you know, by all means, that's one of your rights in these state-directed or, you know, federally funded programs, is that you have the right to choose your provider. So exercise that right and get somebody great to help that sweet little girl. All right, I think we're at the end of our show.
Okay.
Okay, join us next week, 6 o'clock on Sunday night. I'd love to get some callers. I think next week, to anybody that calls, I'm going to give away some DVDs. I think we ought to do that to get some callers. What do you think, Kate?
Hey, they're your DVDs.
What'd you say?
They're your DVDs. That would be very nice. And it is the holidays.
I would love to give away some. Yes, I was going to say it's the holidays. I'd love to give away some DVDs. So call the show so we can help you along with that. All right, that's all for this week.
Okay,
thanks.
Bye.
Bye.